I recently heard a comedian making fun of my home state of Kentucky. He said, "You know you're from Kentucky if your house is mobile and your three cars aren't." He then asked, "If a Kentucky couple gets divorced, are they still brother and sister?" Perhaps more than any other state, Kentucky is labeled and illustrated as redneck and poor, a region of feuds, moonshine stills, drunken mountain men, fat hags with rags wrapped around their heads, smoking corncob pipes and holding shotguns, everyone driving vehicles resembling the one on the Beverly Hillbillies. Someone said Kentucky's state motto ought to be, "We have guns and we are drunk." These stereotypes, while greatly exaggerated, I would suggest, do have some basis in reality. According to the latest census data, Kentucky ranks close to the bottom in several significant categories. Kentucky is 47th in the nation, third from last in percentage of people who complete high school, and 48th in median household income, which is why you sometimes hear Kentuckians say, "Thank God for Mississippi." I have met racists where I come from, and I've met people other people might call backwards. But here's a crucial truth. I have known in Kentucky some of the finest people I have or could ever hope to meet. Brilliant, profoundly insightful, compassionate, people of absolute integrity and moral courage. You never know where you'll find such people. Very often they are in places or in circumstances that you and I might not expect. Some of you may have heard of Osceola McCarty, the small, rather poor, 87-year-old African-American woman from near Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Osceola McCarty had dropped out of school in sixth grade because of family matters. She took up work washing and ironing other people's clothes. She did this for 75 years, much of it without a washing machine. She kept on working as a washerwoman until she was 86 years old, and she would have kept at it except for the arthritis that was ruining her hands. The next year, at age 87, Osceola McCarty walked the 3 miles from her little house to the campus of Southern Mississippi University in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and she handed to the chancellor a gift of $150,000. Her gift for deserving African-American students who otherwise wouldn't have had a chance to go to college. For all those years, she'd been putting aside in a bank account what little money she had. To say the least, she lived frugally. This was her life's savings given for lower income kids to have a chance. But when word got out, people all over the country opened their checkbooks. Very soon, the scholarship fund she had begun had swollen to over $1 million. When Ted Turner heard about it, he was so moved by Osceola McCarty that he gave $1 billion to the United Nations Charity Fund. A reporter asked Miss McCarty why she didn't spend any of that money on herself. She smiled and said, "I am spending it on myself." Most of us are just naturally blown away by such a thing. Who could have imagined a little old elderly Mississippi uneducated black washerwoman would be such a grandly giving benefactor, a huge help to countless students in the inspiration for a great deal more giving. But it occurs to me, as big a surprise as she is, in a way, you and I may be an even bigger surprise. Because given what we know, and given what we have said we believe, how is it possible that we could look at such a woman or any number of other uncelebrated people and not suspect there might be astonishing greatness there, and not wonder what shape their goodness might take? Listen, we pride ourselves on being open-minded people, but we're not so open-minded, not so much. We're actually closed-minded. It's just about everybody else is, except for very little children who haven't yet been ruined. Of course, it's satisfying to believe that we are open-minded people. But think about this. Have you ever met a bigot who didn't make the same claim for himself? I'm open-minded. If we really were, we would imagine better than we imagine. We would keep our curiosity livelier, more vibrant, and withhold our judgments longer, and hold more spaces in our expectations. We'd live with more readiness for more to be revealed. We'd have our doubts, of course, being open-minded. But if our minds were truly open, we would hold our uncertainties more lightly, more happily. Such openness of mind would change how we regard each other, how we regard strangers, and how we regard people we have long assumed that we've gotten to the bottom of knowing. Most of all, such openness might alter a great deal of what we have assumed concerning the most ultimate reality of all. There's a fellow long ago who found himself one day approached by one of his buddies, and his friend said, "We have found the one that's promised in the Bible." The one who's telling this is named Philip, and the one being told is Nathaniel, who now proceeds to guffaw. Over in Nazareth, how can anything good come out of that place, much less the one the Bible promises? He shakes his head. Philip makes, I think, the best possible response. He says, "Come and see." To his great credit, Nathaniel gets up and starts walking. It's a nice day for a walk anyway, and why not? At the very least, he can be open-minded enough and to come and see what this might be about. Turns out Jesus sees him first and says, as Nathaniel is coming up, "Now here's one who is not dishonest, a true Israelite." You think others had ever seen that in Nathaniel? Or is Jesus just open-minded? Nathaniel says, "And you know me how? Oh, I saw you before Philip did. Saw you when you were sitting under that fig tree." Well, who knows what that revelation really meant to Nathaniel, but it had to be something big, because now he suddenly exclaims, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And from Nazareth, no less." It's astounding what a man might find in little podunk Mississippi Nazareth if he were to take his own steps toward a place like that to see for himself what might be. And I wonder if this is why Jesus chose to say, "Now here is an honest man, honest enough to doubt what somebody else believes and is telling him, honest also enough to take his doubts on a walk to see what might be true in spite of his doubts." Now Jesus, who has hailed an honest man, wants to keep him honest in a way many of us find hardest of all. For he goes on to say a different thing. So you've got a belief in me now, do you? And you believe because I saw you, that's it? Listen, you will see greater things. Come and see. Now Jesus starts to talk in cryptic terms about the heavens opening and angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And what on earth is that supposed to mean? I have no idea. Neither does Nathanael. But I wonder if that isn't exactly where Jesus wants him, because this is the way of Jesus with us, to keep our minds from closure, to keep our hearts from finished certainty, to keep us looking for and longing for, ready for, hoping for greater things than these. So here's a question. What do you think about Jesus? Who or what is the Christ to you? Our answers range from admiration for him for being a marvelous moral teacher to very high beliefs about his divinity. But here's a strange thing about our text. Here are two good and open-minded men pouring out a whole spread of beliefs about who he is, son of Joseph, from Nazareth, the promised one, rabbi, the son of God, the king of Israel. But when they come out with all of that, Jesus looks them in the eye and holds out another one. He says, Son of Man. What's that mean? It's mysterious. It's different. It's more. And then he adds, there are greater things awaiting. Jesus is telling them. I think he's telling us, you are not finished. Nothing you have said or thought yet is adequate to the truth. You have no idea how big the truth is. Open up your mind. There is more. Come and see. Follow. Think. Listen. Love. Pray. Lean on each other as you go, and you will see greater things. What would you give to live in a disposition like that, of mind and heart? And does anyone think it's too late to open up your mind and your heart to these greater things? It would be to discover a much larger and deeper awareness of the holy, to awaken to a new sense of the possibilities of God. It is, I believe, to find more of Christ and a greater Christ in the world than we had imagined could be found. And among the greater things we would see are greater things about one another, including ourselves and including our neighbors, including the gleaming in the soul of a poor old washerwoman or certain Kentuckians or of people we have not yet loved enough because we have not yet seen them clearly. By the grace of the one who keeps saying, come and see. Christ has seen them. Christ has seen us. He comes to open our minds, to open our hearts, to open our very souls. And I thought I saw him smiling when he said, come and see. Amen.